Hello and welcome to this, the 8th episode of Foreign, the podcast for foreigners of every flavour. My name's Patrick Garrett. I'm recording this in Montpellier in the south of France, and I'm being joined by...
Yeah, I don't think I need any introduction anymore, Pat. I think if you don't know who I am by now, then you never will.
But that is the face.
But for first-time listeners, my name is Mike Bowden, and I live in Odense in Denmark.
Splendid. So for those of you that listen to our amazing Christmas special that we actually literally published on Christmas Day, I'm still proud of that, Mike.
Yeah, we did well. Yeah, and Happy New Year, by the way.
Yeah. Happy New Year to our listener.
To
our Indonesian listener.
Please get in contact.
We've got a listener in Indonesia. Yeah. Like, we're pretty stoked about that.
Yeah. Please get in contact. that'd be fantastic to hear from someone from Indonesia.
Mr. Indonesia or Mrs. Indonesia. We want you to know that you are valued. So in our Christmas special, we did a bit of a roundup on what Christmas was like in Denmark and what Christmas was like in France. And Mike did very well indeed. He gave us an amazing rundown of what a traditional Christmas is in Denmark. And I failed terribly because... Mike was actually married to a Danish woman, and he lives the Danish dream. Whereas I am married to a, I'm married to an English woman. So we spend all of our time over Christmas doing kind of legacy English stuff, I suppose. And I don't really have a huge amount of experience of what happens in a French household over Christmas, but. Instead of doing the news story this week, we're going to recap a little bit because I actually did think about what happens in France over Christmas. So I'm going to tell you, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, I think we had a message from your brother on Instagram. Is that right?
Yeah, saying that if you want to know about a Danish Christmas and if you don't want to know, then have a listen. But if you, something along the lines of if you don't want to know anything about French Christmas, you should also listen. Or something, suitably sarcastic, and I think Maz also said again with a sort of a sparkle in the eye and a knowing wink that Pat should pull himself together.
Oh my God!
Yeah, pull yourself together. It was the
oh my God!
And Maz is one of our biggest fans, so you're disappointing your public, Pat.
There was nothing wrong with my delivery, with my performance in our Christmas special.
No, I mean, just...
I was completely together. Thank you very much, Maz.
But also this, just before you start, because this, you recapping the French Christmas actually fits in with our very first email that we've got.
Okay.
From someone...
Oh my God,
And I don't know if you know them, Pat, but it's someone called Aide Garrett. I don't know if that's...
I've met her, yeah.
Yeah, you've met her a few times. And it says, "Hello, chaps. When you move to another country to live, do you take your own country's feast days and festivals with you?" Well, we kind of already know the answer to that one, Pat. "Adopt the new, celebrate the lot, or ignore them all. Lots of love, Mum. P.S. Love the show!" !! That's the kind of emails we want. Yeah,
that's it. No, she will love that. Well, Aide, Mum, this is for you.
Yeah,
and for Mike's brother who now I have to behave properly for.
Yeah.
This is what happens in France over Christmas. So basically, I said during the last recording that French Christmas is very similar to British Christmas, and it is, which is why kind of I sort of detached myself from Christmas a little bit. Like, obviously we do celebrate it, but I don't really hold much truck in Christmas personally. So I kind of I've been here for so long that it kind of just sort of what happens here during Christmas time kind of just washes over me. But I did have a chat with a few of my neighbours, and the 24th is a thing.
Right.
Yeah, I sort of knew that, but like I didn't know. I thought it was just a regional thing because we used to live in the northeast of France,
okay,
near Germany, and our neighbour, my next door neighbour, both of our neighbours, in fact, celebrate Christmas. They have their main Christmas meal on the 24th of December.
Right.
So there you go, and the Christmas tree and the presents thing is a standard, Mike. That's something that happens in France as well. Obviously, the sapin is called in France, which is a pine, is something that you buy in the supermarket or the petrol station, and yeah. you take it back to your house and stick it up and cover it with sparkly shit. And the meal, the food was something, honestly, again, like I've been here for so long that it just seems so normal. Like, I didn't even kind of register. So like, according to various web pages that I looked at, and this is pretty much true, foie gras, which is the goose liver stuff, caviar, oysters, they're called huîtres en français, and are kind of like a staple. And they have generally a bird for Christmas, and it's usually a duck or a capon, or a turkey, or depending on which region of France you're in, fish, apparently.
Okay.
But like in the northeast where we used to live, it was capon, which is a castrated cockerel, and they're much, much cheaper than turkey and a lot easier to cook. I don't know. I don't think it's a very British thing to eat capon. In fact, I think turkey is the main deal. But there you go. Like the fish thing is a really religious thing. Some people, France is a Catholic country, for those that don't know, and so fish is a kind of seen as like a meager meat, if you like. So instead of sort of gorging yourself on the luxury of capon and turkey, you're supposed to feed on like horrible fish. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is the Christmas market, obviously, which is really certainly in the northeast of France, in the east of France, where the border with Germany is a massive, massive deal. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Strasbourg Christmas markets, but I think Strasbourg Christmas market is visited by more than 2 million people a year now. And apparently the residents are up in arms, Mike, because the foreigners are coming to invade our Christmas, etc.
How dare they? How dare they?
That's it. How very dare those foreigners, those spending people that come to your tourist attraction. There you go. Christmas in France, Mike. That's pretty much all I've got.
Yeah.
It's really similar to, as far as I can gather, it's very, very similar.
But you said they did it on the 24th, so when did they open their presents? On the 25th? Or did they open them on the 24th?
I don't know. I actually think it's the 25th because it like continues. I think
right.
So,
okay.
So you do what you do. Your main Christmas Eve banana. It's probably similar. I'm making this up, but I'm guessing it's pretty similar to what you described. You open one or two as a sort of like as a taster, and then the main event maybe comes the next day. But I don't know. I will check that though, Mike, and I'll bring that information to the next episode.
Fantastic.
All right, Maz, don't you worry. I'll fill you right in on France Christmas, French Christmas, whatever. Sorry, got to get myself together.
Well, one thing I heard recently, I don't know if I listen to lots of football podcasts. And there's something called the Europod, and they have a guy from it's like Italian correspondent, German, French, whatever. Anyway, the French, Julien Laurent, he said he had a raclette for Christmas.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's anything that you've heard of.
It's a French thing, but it's a tradition in the northeast, in like the mountain ranges in the Les Vosges, which is like the opposite side of the valley from the Black Forest in Germany.
Ah.
So basically the bottom of that valley, that's where the Rhine is. So like you've got the sort of French mountain range on one side, which is called Les Vosges, and on the other side you have the Black Forest. I can't remember what it's called, Schwarzwald.
Yeah.
In Deutschland, and the raclette. Do you know what it is? Did he mention what it was?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did my homework, so I looked it up. You know,
tell you what, you and your brother Mike, you go fuck yourselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah, it's like a sort of a tabletop grill type situation, right?
That's it. Yeah. And it's mainly for raclette is actually a type of cheese.
Yeah.
So you have it. You have a sort of there's like a circular thing. Fucking hell, I've got no idea what to call it. It's a bit like a fondue kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like they have a circular thing in the middle of the table, and each person has their own sort of shovel, and you put on the shovel, you put your slice of cheese. You can buy it like pre-sliced in supermarkets, or you know, the fromager will slice it for you or whatever. And you put your piece of cheese on the shovel and whatever other bits of shit you want to put on there, and you sort of stick it into the sort of portable fire in the middle of the table until it's all bubbly and that. And then you take it out and you tip it onto your potatoes. It's always potatoes. And you can have it in restaurants. You kind of get your food and then they'll bring this, they'll like heat this enormous raclette cheese. It's huge. It's like, it looks like a Gouda. Is that right? A giant wheel of cheese.
Yeah.
Like they have a sort of special rack for it basically. And they sort of like, you know, sort of blowtorch the inside of it basically until it's all like melting and bubbly. And then they bring it to your table and they just sort of like slice it sort of down onto your food. So you get this enormous like avalanche of fat basically
Sounds amazing.
Fucking Merry Christmas.
Yeah, that's it. But anyway, Pat, Christmas, that's so last year. You know,
I'm over it. Yeah, tell me about what's happening right now, Mike.
What's happening right now is that I think Denmark is still reeling from the shock of the announcement on New Year's Eve. The big Danish tradition on New Year's Eve is everyone gathers around the television at around about 6 o'clock because the Queen addresses the nation. And I think in England, it's on Christmas Day the Queen, or the King now, maybe speaks to the nation or spoke to the nation via television. But in Denmark...
Do you know, Mike, I just want to interrupt that. I've literally never seen the Queen or the King's speech. Never.
No, I don't think I ever have.
Not once ever.
No, I don't think I ever have. But, you know, when I tell people that I don't watch the Queen's sort of New Year's speech, the sort of, you know, the...
Are they flabbergasted?
Yeah. The eyes widen. They're kind of like, everyone's like aghast.
In fear.
Like, what do you mean you don't listen to the Queen? And it's like, well, I don't really care. But anyway, she dropped what, again, Alan Partridge would call a bombshell on the 31st of December, that after 52 years on the throne, she is abdicating.
Yep.
And... people went, and maybe are still, but people went absolutely ballistic. You know, people sitting in their front rooms crying. People were kind of screaming, no, no, it can't be true. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Screaming. There's like reels on Instagram of, and again, you would think that these kind of reactions would maybe come from kind of our generation and maybe even older. But these reactions are kind of from like teenagers and people in their early 20s. Mm, people going absolutely crazy that the Queen, well, will no longer be Queen. I think it's on January the 14th, I believe, that her son, Kong Prince Frederik, which is just the Crown Prince Frederick, will be taking over and he'll be King. And it's massive, Pat. It couldn't be bigger. It's seismic.
if you say so, Mike.
It's and I know that you've read up a bit on Dronning Margrethe.
I did read a little bit.
Queen Margaret, yeah.
But nothing. I mean, like basically, as I said when I was doing the when I was reading about her, I was. I mean, basically, there's just such a like an enormous history. I had no idea, for example. I've got to be absolutely honest. I had no idea Denmark had a royal family.
And, the oldest royal family, in fact.
Apparently so. And I had no idea that that Margaret, God bless her, God save her, is about to stop being the longest reigning monarch in Europe.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal. I think... a lot of people's reaction is because she has always been there, like a part of the furniture. So it's just, she's kind of just been, there. So the fact that she's not going to be there anymore is this kind of just this huge deal. And, but why is that interesting, Pat? Really? What's that got to do with us? And, you know, it's.
You tell me, Mike. Let's have it.
Well, I think, you know. In terms of this podcast and in terms of why I find it interesting is the idea of the royal family kind of representing, or not kind of, like the royal family representing the idea of where you come from, of the nation. Yep. So, like, you know, the Danish royal family, for in many ways, embodies Denmark and the idea of being Danish.
Okay.
And I think for many people, perhaps in the UK, not us, well, we don't live there, but yeah, the royal family has the same kind of effect. You know, we don't wave flags very much in Britain, but we certainly do. Wave flags if it's when it was the Queen's birthday or the coronation, etc., etc., etc. So the idea of nationalism is really kind of sort of connected intrinsically with the royal family.
Yeah,
and I think that's interesting. But also, what I find interesting is the idea of there's a social scientist, a British social scientist called Michael Billig, and from Loughborough University, and he wrote he's written a book. I've forgotten what the book's called. I think the book actually might be called. It doesn't matter, but it's about a concept called banal nationalism, or in a way, everyday nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And what that basically means is that you do things which which kind of confirm the idea of a nation state, but subconsciously or indirectly.
Yeah.
So in Denmark, for example, I don't know about France. In Denmark, if there's a birthday, you have a Danish flag outside the house, usually just a sort of like on a sort of a wooden stick. Lots of people just in general have Danish flags in their back garden. But if it's a birthday, then there'd be Danish flags on the table, or the sort of little serviettes would be with Danish flag. There'd be also a tiny little flag on the sort of breakfast table or on the sort of party table. Even at Christmas, you can have these sort of almost like sort of mini bunting, a string with these wooden kind of angular Danish flags on them around the Christmas tree. And so the idea of, but no one really is consciously thinking, yeah, it's a birthday, go Denmark. But so it's, but you would notice it more, he says, if it wasn't there. So people don't actually kind of pay attention to the fact that it's there. They're not consciously sort of celebrating Denmark, but they wouldn't. But they would notice it if it was gone. And I think that what we saw here with the Queen is this classic example of this banal nationalism. The fact that they're all of a sudden, this person is not there. It just sent the country in some kind of tailspin.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting, I mean, he compared it also to America, where, you know, the police have the American flag on their uniform and there are American flags waving outside of buildings that no one really pays any attention to. But it does kind of, give this idea of a nation state. But, he calls it sort of this banal nationalism. And I think that the royal family, especially in Denmark, and it may be in some cases in the UK, is a really good kind of symbol of this sort of everyday nationalism.
Yeah, I think just to take the British example, I mean, the British royal family is an amazing example as to talk about royalty in general. And that is absolutely the case. I mean, like, there are, you know, a great many people, virtually everyone, in fact, who's alive, either, if they're really old, you know, like, either remembers the Queen Elizabeth II getting coronated, or, you know, she was the queen for their entire lives. And, you know, when you have this messaging, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about sort of political messaging, about governmental messaging, about nation, culture, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're absolutely right. Any form of monarchy in Britain or Denmark apparently is absolutely a part of that, and an intrinsic part of that, as you said. You know, I think it's important as well to... I think what he's saying is absolutely correct, you know, and I think that, but I think it's the same for anything that you've taken for granted for your entire life, you know, when it's taken away for whatever reason, it is shocking. It's a bit like when a marriage fails, for example, you know, it can, the effect can be extremely destabilizing, you know, it's, you know, in France, like, we have nowhere near the same type of presence of the flag, for example, like, none at all. I mean, remember,
really?
You know, obviously, France is founded on the revolution. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, we can't, you know, any kind of sort of, like, flag waving is seen as, like, bellicose nationalism. It's only, like, the only place, it's reserved, really, for government buildings. It's the only place you see it, honestly. Like, it's you certainly don't, you know, hanging French flags on your Christmas tree. That would mark you out as, like,
really. Yeah, and that's how I've grown up in London as well. I mean, the only time you can wave a flag, an English flag, is maybe if England are playing in the World Cup. But
exactly.
But even then, if you do it, then you might be sort of associated with kind of, you know, neck tattoos
and
too many muscles. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, British bulldogs.
But I mean, I did do a bit of digging on the British monarchy because you know, for the record, I am not a monarchist at all. I just want to make that crystal clear. I did do a little bit of digging. Now, normally, I ignore the monarchy completely. I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but the Danish monarch actually had an insane approval rating. It was like 72%, apparently, which is crazy. I mean, like, you know, that royal family is not going anywhere. Let's say that.
No.
But just to compare it to the British monarchy, apparently now, like, since it's 62%, and like one in four people now, 25%. This is according to a YouGov poll, would prefer a republic.
How many did you say?
One in four, it's 25%.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So that's why it's saying, like...
But hold on a sec, you just said the Danish was 72%. So that would mean that also 28% of Danes would prefer a republic, or what?
Yeah, but there's also, like, doesn't know or whatever.
Oh, okay, yeah, and kind of don't mind it.
Don't care.
Yeah, don't care. Yeah, right, exactly, okay, but 25% of the British public actually want...
Yeah, would actually want to get rid of the monarchy.
Yeah.
So, like, it's...
Go Britain.
Yeah, that's it. Another part of that poll said that Britain. The question was: Do Britons think Do you think that the monarchy is good for the country?
Right.
And only 58% said yes.
Wow.
So like, it's not, you know, things have changed. I don't want to speculate on, like, what, you know, what happened since, like, Elizabeth's death, but I'm hazarding a guess that it's gone down a bit. Just to compare what you were saying about this sort of, like, hysterical reaction to the removal of the Queen or the disappearance of the Queen, if you like. I mean, like, we saw, like, very similar things in Britain. It is comparable, you know, there are parallels. And, like, certainly when Elizabeth was buried, I mean, that was
crazy, yeah.
I actually did some work on that at school because, like, we were working on the idea of life as an attraction, as a theme park, and, like, which is actually, you know, something that only really happened at the end of the 19th century, this idea, you know, like, national monuments and... walking about the city and, you know, people watching, etc., etc. Paris was like the world sort of first of that. It was like a model of, you know, like shopping, for example, like, you know, going into town on a, you know, and just walking around, looking at people, like window shopping, etc., etc.
Okay.
That hasn't been around for very long at all, that idea, you know, and it was like really centered, like Paris was seen as kind of, you know, the sort of, like, center of the world in terms of where to be, to live life, et cetera, et cetera. And a big part of that, or a one of the main phenomenons of that, was the opening of the public morgue, where you could actually go into the morgue. There's an amazing book on this. I've only read bits on it, but, like, you could go to the morgue to look at dead people, like, because, like, in the lore, obviously, they had to display corpses, I think, for, like, legal reasons, for identification reasons, so that the public could come and see them and blah de blah. And basically, before this happened, obviously, no one cared, no one went to see them, but after when people kind of got wind that they could actually go and see dead people, it was a real phenomenon in terms of the amount of people that actually went there. Like literally tens of thousands of people would turn up just to see any old corpse. Like, you know, so
wow.
Basically the sort of like birth of the idea of death as an attraction. And so what you saw with Elizabeth was kind of, you know, it was pretty ghoulish. You know, there were a lot of people there. Like
24
saying, like,
hours, basically, people give her 24 Yeah,
this is it. Like,
hours.
You know, to not even see... What did you actually see when you go in there?
Like, I very much doubt you saw her, right?
The closed coffin surrounded by soldiers, right?
And draped in some kind of flag or garb or whatever.
So you get basically effectively what you have is like this sort of an extremely codified ritual of death as a sort of a theme park attraction. Well, like the, you know, the queue was actually had markers just as you would see in like a theme park, like Alton Towers or whatever.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. 2 hours to the dead queen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, and so I'm just making that comparison because like, I think it's important to be able to sort of like understand the role that like monarchy plays, as you say, in like national identity, because they're effectively part of like the national show, if you like.
Right.
And this
yeah.
idea, as you're talking about the idea of banal nationalism, I mean, yeah, I don't think you're going to find a much better example of that than the royals. It's like I think for a lot of people, I think the line of thought is changing in Britain now, but I think like as you saw last week in Denmark, you know, the idea of like the royal family going away is just like no way, like on a general level, you know.
Yeah, I think that brings nicely to the because I listened to this podcast with that Michael Billig, and he was talking about, and I think this explains, talking about the royal family, and but it explains maybe why in Britain, and perhaps we might see this in Denmark, why after King Charles, that the popularity went down, and maybe it's not just due to the fact that the Queen has always been there, and the Danish Queen has always been there, and now there's something new coming, but he says that he did a huge study. Dozens of families where they just spoke about their relationship with the royal family. And he actually, just for the social sciences out there that kind of, you know, we're kind of interested in how these sort of studies are done. He actually got someone else to do the interviews for him because he didn't want his own preconceived ideas affecting his line of questions. So this person he hired to do it for him had no idea what he wanted to get out of it. That basically was just talk to families about how they feel about the royal family. And what he said was, what he found out was, the sort of narrative about the royal family, and I think this is really interesting, is that people perceive that being royal is some kind of poison chalice. It's like a golden cage. So he said everyone that was pretty much spoken, no matter what social class they had, he said people who even were afraid to go outside their door because of they feared violence on the streets would say they wouldn't want to swap their lives with the royal family because of the narrative that their lives are so controlled, right? Yeah. And on one hand, that's really it's interesting on different levels. On one level, he concludes that I think is really interesting that having the royal family actually helps maintain the sort of the social divide, because if you then see wealth or kind of power or this kind of elite as being something negative, then you stay where you are.
So
this person who's really, really poor and afraid to go outside, you know, will think, well, compared to them, I'm happy to be where I am.
Yeah, that's it.
So the royal family in that sense actually helps to maintain this class divide and this sort of, and helps sort of, well, not helps, but stifles social mobility.
Yep.
And, but also the other thing is now that we can see, because, I mean, he was talking about Lady Di, God bless her, Pat, but he was actually saying that loads of people think or believe today that she was always really popular. but she actually wasn't before she died. And he said that the support for the royal family is strongest when people sort of, when that narrative to them is confirmed that they are sacrificing for the country. So so the idea of the Queen, you know, that she's made this huge sacrifice for Great Britain, so we don't really mind that she has like golden carriages and a multi-billionaire or whatever. But as soon as people are sort of the royals seem to be having too much fun and they break that narrative, that's when we have a problem with it. So Lady Di, you know, she was with Dodi Al-Fayed and, you know, and on boats having fun. So her popularity was actually quite low. You know, how dare she do this on taxpayers' money? And so I think that the popularity with Charles is because now all of a sudden, I think that Charles's kind of national sort of perception is maybe, I don't know, that he's got it easy and he's always had it easy and he hasn't made those kind of sacrifices. And Camilla Parker Bowles, she's just sort of, you know, piggybacked her way to being queen. So therefore, the support for Charles and Camilla as king and queen of the country automatically falls. So, and sorry to go on, but I presented this argument to my students, and one of them, and it was a really good point that he made, Arnaz, he's not listening, but he said, well, isn't that the same as anyone who gets something from the state? And then so we made a bit of a joke that, you know, that the royal family are kind of sort of their benefit scroungers, right? I mean, we don't mind giving people social benefit if we actually see that they're struggling and trying to find work. But as soon as we see them maybe having a bit of a decent life out of it, then we kind of, then our noses get put out of joint. And I think that that kind of relates to the royal family in a huge way.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, there really is no better example of a device that maintains like vertical authority in any society than monarchy. And it is that simple. It doesn't get any more singular than that. Do you know what I mean? I mean, just that is absolutely correct. You know, the media messaging around the royals is extremely controlled, you know, and like obviously we've seen in the last year, especially in Britain, you know, sort of trouble for people like Prince Andrew, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, how this all relates to like being foreign, like as we said, is because it creates a narrative whereby you are either British or you are not. If you are, you know, like for example, a good example was when Jeremy Corbyn refused to stand for the national anthem, or was it stand or sing or something?
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn was the previous leader of the Labour Party in the UK. For those and who don't know who he is,
he was fucking pilloried for it.
Yeah,
you know, you are not allowed in politics to be effectively an anti-monarchist. You're not allowed because the press won't allow you to be so, because they will just fucking destroy you. And like, you know, the simple truth is that like everything we are talking about is effectively a narrative that is given to us by the media. Like it's a narrative about
this sacrifice that, you know, there is no sacrifice. There is none, you know.
Of course. I mean, just
it's a great life. It must be a fantastic life.
I'm pretty sure, like being a prince isn't shit. Like, you know,
yeah,
you probably wake up this morning and just go, you know, you don't like, oh my god, not again. I don't believe that.
But the same is true for Denmark. I was speaking to a friend of mine. We mentioned it before, Jakob, and we were sort of talking about this. And I also remember there was a story a few years ago, where there's this big bridge, it's called Storebæltsbroen, big bridge connecting the island that I live on to the island called Sjælland, where Copenhagen is on. And obviously in extreme weather, it gets closed for traffic. And there was one night where it was closed for traffic, but then it got out that the Crown Prince Frederick, he had to get home, so they kind of drove across anyway. And, you know, that you get pilloried for. So again, as soon as you're taking a liberty, then no. Oi, no. But I think what you're saying about the media is also interesting, because Michael Billig also talks about that and how the media also perpetuates this kind of banal nationalism, talking about even something as obvious as the weather. You get the weather for the country that you're in, and then you maybe get the weather for the rest of the world. He also mentions that, and I found this very interesting as well, because there's something else that I've noticed, that he says in Britain, we'll talk about the Prime Minister, and we obviously mean the British Prime Minister. But what I find interesting about Denmark is, that I find completely unnecessary, is that if they talk about the royal family or the Prime Minister, they'll say the Danish royal family or the Danish Prime Minister. And I'm thinking, well, who else would it be? Like, if you're talking about the German Prime Minister, then say, obviously, den Tyske Kanzler, the German Prime Minister, or the French Prime Minister, but whatever. But no, they'll say the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen. And I thought, well, what other Prime Minister would it be? Like, you know, and also, obviously, with sports, I think he mentions the fact that there was a, during the Olympics or something, there was this big story about the girls' hockey team, that they won this amazing match. And he noticed that the other team, what country that was, wasn't actually mentioned. And so, so you know, and I think, yeah, Denmark especially, really, you know, we can maybe do another episode on this, but certain sections, at least, of Danish media, you know, there's, just to give you a headline that... I'm in a kind of a Facebook Messenger group with a couple of colleagues, and they and we send each other these kind of really sort of jingoistic nutcase headlines. And one was, there was a handball game, right? Denmark is handball is huge over here. And anyway, the headline was, German handball player gets goosebumps during Danish national anthem.
Oh, my God.
And that was the story. That was it. Because they spoke to him after the game and they'd asked him, and he said, yeah, the atmosphere was fantastic. I got goosebumps probably, or something like that. But that was the headline to get you to read it. And the thing is, it works, because obviously they wouldn't do it if it didn't work.
If it didn't, yeah.
And a lot of Danish people, you know, those kind of the two people, Søren and Theis, they kind of maybe laugh it off a bit. But I think, because that must be a kind of an editorial decision. So someone at the top says, we want these types of things. And the news company or people who do it is basically like ITV in the UK. It's called TV Tall in Denmark. So it's, you know, it's not just this kind of small sort of maybe right-wing newspaper. It's a sort of, but yeah, just German handball player gets goosebumps during Danish national anthem. I mean, wow. Mm. Like, wow. Wow. Yeah. But again, people don't think about it. You know, they don't, you know, it doesn't register. It's only the fact that I mention it or we've got this joke about it that it becomes more apparent to them. But it isn't really something that a lot of people just notice, because it's just sort of there, you know.
Okay. I mean, in France, it's not the same, because like we don't, there are really strict rules on like on the French press. Like the history of the French press is really detailed, and it's like, it's, you know, any kind of sort of overt nationalism is kind of, it's difficult to sort of to justify. There would be a lot of people that would tell you that you shouldn't do that effectively. But in Britain, obviously, I mean, don't want to talk about the British press really, because like it's just want to say that really that effectively it does absolutely perpetuate the national narrative. Like in France, like the national narrative is the revolution, basically. In Britain, it's kind of, you know, World War II, we beat Hitler, blah blah. That's, you know, everything that I was kind of like taught at school. And like, you know, obviously the monarchy is just a massive part of that. It was like, we did this with the royal family.
Yeah.
Effectively. And it's to see the way that, you know, the press operates in Britain, I mean, it's pretty appalling, to be honest. I mean, it's one of the biggest, I've got to say, like in terms of, you know, talking about the British monarchy and, you know, the British press, it was a huge reason in me leaving the UK. It was just like, I did not want to live in a country, really, and like, you know, where it was unacceptable to be an anti-monarchist. I couldn't deal with that, because like it's you know, it's not something that, as far as I'm concerned, if you're in a situation when you are being presented with a social truth, such as monarchy, and that truth is being held in place through an artificial narrative via the media, and any opposition to that is dealt with by an unfree system, if you like, to sort of stifle any kind of dissent, then you're in a situation I don't want to be in socially.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, monarchy is not a pretty thing. I'm gonna tell you a little story, Mike. Right.
Oh, great.
I'm gonna give you a bit of fucking history.
Okay? Oh, wow. Yeah. So I am sitting comfortably. You may begin.
So there's this guy called Herodot, who was a Greek philosopher, right?
And right.
He was the first person that actually mentioned the word democracy. He was the first person that actually used the word.
Okay.
So this was in like the 5th century BC. And he described he was the first person to describe different forms of government or governance, if you like. So he described oligarchy, which was what was going on in Marseille at the time, which was it's a very old colony, and it was controlled by oligarchs. Democracy, he was Greek, and you know what was emerging in Greece at the time was a form of direct democracy, which is pretty unique, hasn't really existed anywhere else, and was relatively short-lived, only lasted for a few hundred years, and monarchy. And he was talking about the Persian Empire.
Yeah.
So like Aristotle, about 100 years later, right, he was very critical of monarchy. He was extremely critical. He wrote a book called Politics, La Politique in French. And he basically said that monarchy should only be reserved for societies that can't self-govern. He said basically if you can't look after yourselves as a population, then you maybe do need some kind of like strict control to prevent chaos effectively.
Right.
But like people like Aristotle and Socrates, they described, like, for example, like, you know, battlefield units that had no leaders at all. You know, so like they were talking about, like Aristotle did that in Politics. He basically gives sort of like three different sort of like lines of governance, and gives like the sort of like positive ends of the scale and negative ends of the scale for each one. So on monarchy is like the good side, and the bad side of that is tyranny, like, you know, dictatorship effectively.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we say by monarchy, we're talking about one leader, you know, as opposed to a king or a queen, you know, that's a pretty like new concept, you know, relatively. I mean, I say that, but like, you know, a long time after fucking Aristotle anyway. I'll come back to that in a second though. Like aristocracy, which was which is one side, which was the good side, and oligarchy, which was the bad side. He said it, you know, it was no good to anyone.
Mm.
And the politie, which is people governance, or we would call it anarchism today, I suppose. And
yeah.
And at the other end of that, you have democracy, and democracy was used in a negative sense. The interesting thing about this is that both the Greeks and the Romans abolished monarchy. Like they both got rid of it. I don't know the exact dates, but it was, I think, in fact, I do know the exact date. For Rome, it was abolished in 509 BC. Was the end of the last Roman king.
Mm.
Because they both came to the conclusion that monarchy is dangerous for the citizens of any society. So Rome abolished monarchy to preserve the freedom of its citizens. So what you have, like, basically, they got rid of their kings, and they created a republic. Greece got rid of monarchy to preserve the political equality of citizens. This is why you had this, or the rise of direct democracy in Greece.
Yeah.
But like they were both completely, you know, agreed on the fact that monarchy should not exist. And really what happened in terms of the construction of the Roman Republic, the idea was to create a sort of perfect balance between the three elements that Herodot mentioned, which was oligarchy, monarchy, and democracy. Like the idea that the three sort of pillars of the society were basically sort of safety check the others, so that you can't sort of like slip into these, you know, if you have, for example, a direct democracy, you know, so the people like start to get like too powerful, then you would have like some form of check, like the monarchy or the aristocracy, that would be able to sort of like, you know, stop people revolting, basically. So you would have these sort of like three elements in place, which is effectively pretty much describes like France, actually, like modern day France. We live in these sort of like bastard republics, so, you know, which are based on exactly the same ideas. You have Macron, the president. You have the, you know, the Senate and the Assembly below him. Mm. And then you have this democratic element. What you don't have is these legacy monarchs. Now, it's just a really long-winded way of saying that, like, whether or not, like, people get, like, really upset about it, you know, I would say that that is probably due, in fact, to the fact that, you know, the press is so powerful in our societies that, you know, they can construct effectively any narrative they like. You know, I would say that we should probably side with the Greeks and the Romans, Mike, and we should abolish monarchies in Europe. That's what I'm saying. And, like, you know, the fact that fucking... I think the... It's too easy to say that, you know, the monarchies that we have are powerless. You know, when you've got people like, you know, 20-year-old kids like fucking crying in their kitchen because Queen Margaret is going to take a bit of a sabbatical after 52 years suffering on the throne.
Yeah.
I think you and I and the rest of our listener, yeah, you know, should question that, Mike. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think maybe to sort of round it up, they asked Michael Billig what he thought, what he actually, was he a Republican or did he support the royal family? And he said it was a difficult question for him. He said that maybe deep down he's a Republican, but he said that if there was going to be a royal family, and I think this is quite interesting, and again, I asked my students, he said he thinks there should be a national lottery every 20 years. So
I like that. That's pretty cool. I do like that.
I actually quite like that idea. So every 20 years, and I'm sure, obviously, if you have served your country for 20 years as a royal, you'll be looked after. So I don't think you'll be kind of taken from the streets and live like a king, for 20 years and then cast back down again. But yeah, I like that idea as well. Actually, have a lottery, and if you really do think that it's such a huge sacrifice to be a royal, then don't buy a ticket. But I'm pretty sure that, as I said, I asked my students, again, an incredibly small, unrepresented sample size, but they were all pretty much agreed on that it was this sacrifice. But they would all buy a lottery ticket to be them. So yeah, there you go. So there you go. Yeah.
What a paradox, Mike. Look,
yeah,
that's that.
It. Yeah, yeah, fantastic. But, and I suppose, again, just to, you know, keeping in the theme of our podcast, I would say that, yeah, just for that half an hour on December the 31st, is there where I might feel kind of, you know, and this is in no way a negative thing or in no way a kind of sympathetic thing, but where I kind of feel most foreign, because I just don't care what she's had to say. You know, she's an intelligent woman and she seems like a nice person, but like, why am I listening to her? Like, you know, you could just as well listen to somebody else. But, you know, that opinion isn't popular.
Mm.
So I just sort of smile and, you know, I didn't listen to it. How could you not listen to it? But yeah, you know, even Danish teachers at at the college where I work, you know, they'll take the Queen's speech and there will be kind of, that will be a topic for the next lesson after January. Well, they'll analyze the Queen's speech and do a sort of a rhetorical analysis of it and what she's saying and everything else. So it's just like, again, banal nationalism. It's just that's just sort of what it is. And that kind of keeps you Danish, right? It keeps you Danish and it represents community and it represents community. And in some ways that's a good thing. And in other ways, maybe not so much. Yeah.
I would probably say it's not that good a thing, personally. I mean, like, you know, just to, you know, the last thing I'm going to say, otherwise we're going to have our listener listening for way too long. Like at school recently, my boys had to sing, they had to learn the words and sing the French national anthem.
About bloody time.
Which is exactly what the teacher said. She said it was their music teacher who said, like, it's about time you learnt it.
That's it.
And honestly, like, I was pretty fucking furious, to be honest. Like, but they did it. They did it. God love them. I told them, I said, like, seriously, if you want to stand there and say, I'm not singing this, like, I will back you up. I'll come in and tell them you should have, you know, should have gone to sing something else. So they refused.
Did they?
They both did it. Yeah, fucking turncoats.
Yeah, I actually again after all the years I've been here, I don't know the words to the Danish national anthem either.
I don't know the words to the fucking French national anthem. Yeah. I don't know the words to the British one. Fuck all that shit, Mike. Honestly, like, seriously, I just I've got extremely low tolerance for it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like you're right. It is completely banal. It's just something that's. I don't know. I just think people are. I don't know. I wouldn't like even generalize in that way. It's just kind of there.
It's not for you.
It's not for me. It's not for me, Mike.
But I think fuck this shit is probably a good place to end it.
Sorry. So fuck this shit, Mike. And yeah. I think on that note, I think we better round this episode out.
Yeah.
I just want to apologize to Mike's brother. For not being together for the Christmas special, and I hope this.
No, that was Matt. Matt says you should pull yourself together. My brother was.
I feel bad about that.
Yeah.
And, I hope this episode made up for it.
I think it more than makes up for it, Pat. I think you sharp as a whatever knife.
Sharp as a fucking thing.
Yeah, as a sharp thing.
That's it. Sharp as a thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, many, many thanks for listening if you've made it this far. We'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about some other topic related to foreign people and nations.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.